Well, hello everyone. Coming to the end of the second full day. I'm hoping you're enjoying your practice a little bit here and there. Starting to see some interesting things in your direct experience. Starting to get a deeper understanding about how to practice well. Why to practice, and I wanted to offer some reflections tonight on this why do we practice piece that Dave started last night, offer some of my reflections on the Buddha's teachings about the Dharma. We practice, I guess maybe the title of this talk would be Seeing Through to the truth of things. We cultivate this clear seeing practice so that we can see the way things are. The way things are. The way things are. I want to unpack this a little bit, these statements. This quote that Dave offered last night, I just wanted to reiterate. The Buddha thinking, it says, I considered the Buddha thinking that this Dhamma that I have attained is profound, hard to see, and hard to understand, peaceful and sublime, unattainable by mere reasoning, subtle to be experienced by the wise. Profound, hard to see, and hard to understand, unattainable by mere reasoning. I like that in that statement. He's like, you can't think your way into this Dharma. Dharma is the Pali word for the truth of things or the truth of reality. Dharma is the Sanskrit word. They mean the same thing. You might hear me switching off between them tonight. I like to use the word the design of things as a definition that makes sense to me about this word Dhamma or Dharma, what the Buddha saw clearly, what was revealed to him when he turned his attention inward and very closely looked at his own experience. He saw, I like the design of things because it emphasizes the foundational and inescapable nature of this Dhamma. It is describing basically, the nature of the world as experienced through the human organism. So it's how the observable world or a human being, how a mind-heart, how a body is designed, how we are designed to function, to operate. These really sort of basic facts of life, if you will. This is what the truth of things means, the Dhamma. And most especially, in the Dhamma path, specifically to the Dhamma path, the truth of how our suffering comes to be. And when we, like the Buddha, can look at our experience and see and observe and sense directly, experientially, how that is, how that comes to be our suffering. And it is in that understanding that we understand, that we get, that we can sort of creatively formulate how to let it go, how to be free, how to free ourselves. Within the clear seeing, the wisdom of this clear seeing, there is the way toward the end of suffering, the clear path towards the end of suffering, how we get there in a moment or forever. So when we want to sort of take a look at, as Dave pointed to last night, we want to sort of take a look at our stress and our suffering, unlike what the general culture encourages us to do, And we want to take a look at our difficulties, our stress, our dissatisfaction, our afflictive emotions, and see them operate in our mind bodies moment by moment as process. We want to sort of observe them and let them reveal themselves and their nature, what they're made of, how they come to be, the causal nature of them. And, you know, we want to basically look at, in our own experience, why we suffer. The Buddha said, he had some very sort of brief and pithy summaries of his teachings. And one of them was, he said, we suffer because we are thinking wrongly about life, about the nature of things, about the design of things. We're thinking wrongly about what we are and what various aspects of our experience are. But in other words, we suffer because we are ignorant to the truth. We are either unaware of the truth or the other aspect of ignorance, which is we are aware, but we ignore what we know. And so for this reason, we suffer. We have wrong assumptions, beliefs, ways of thinking about things that are wrong because they are basically incorrect, not because they are sort of morally deficit or something, but because they are incorrect, incomplete, usually, not the whole picture, not the whole picture. So we are ignorant to the whole picture. And if we were wise to the whole picture, then we wouldn't suffer. That was the Buddha's statement. So we need to sort of look at that and unpack it, and that's what I'd like to do tonight a little bit. Is it true that we suffer? Every form of suffering that we experience, stress from the slightest irritation to patterns of afflictive emotion and addiction, you know, the most difficult relationships that we have or whatever, are all come from this misapprehension of reality, not having the full picture. And so let's do a thought experiment here. Have you ever got into trouble by making a snap judgment about someone based on a limited amount of information? Yeah? Some of you have? Like you see somebody looks at you in a certain way and your mind goes, oh, they hate me. They must hate me, that person. Look at the way they looked at me with that expression on their face. Your mind, this is how our minds are designed, actually, to take samples of sensory information visually or through any of the other senses and then try to fill in the blanks. Our minds go ahead and try to fill in the blanks and make up a story, a narrative, a belief, a view, an assumption about what that data means, that limited amount of data. And so we can be led down the garden path. If we believe in this assumption, in what the mind is kicking up, the sort of picture that it's constructing or the narrative, we may be led down the garden path of problems that are sort of optional and unnecessary. Like if I decide that you're looking, right now, Stu is looking at me in a way that I'm interpreting through the filter of my self-doubt as disapproving, say, or that I'm, you know, that this Dharma talk is not going well, let's say. He's not really, but I'm just making this up. I mean, I've had plenty of experiences like that, right? I look around at your faces and I'm like, oh, they don't like it. Oh, they like it. Oh, they don't like it. Oh, I'm not clear. You know, my mind is just constantly making up these stories. And to the extent that I believe in them and I get drawn into them and I'm sucked into them, I will suffer. It, you know, whether it's accurate or not, if I'm clinging to that view, but the point I'm making here is if it's inaccurate and incomplete, I could be really just making up a whole batch of suffering that doesn't need to be there, because then I could maybe talk to Stu afterwards and say, hey, Stu, did you not get what the talk, or did you think it was stupid? Was it bad? I saw on your face that you thought it was bad. I saw you falling asleep and stuff. and Stu might say to me something like, oh, no, no, I just, you know, I didn't get much sleep last night, and I was distracted thinking about work, and I was thinking about something totally different, not really having to do with my story at all. He doesn't like me. Do you not like me, dude? What's up? Are you mad at me? What? What do you mean? They might not even know what you're talking about, this moment in time that you have extrapolated into a whole relationship deal, a story. Has that ever happened to you? Okay, good. Good. I hate to think that I was the only delusional one in the room. Good. Yeah. And so then what's really interesting is when we find out later we were wrong. That's the interesting moment when we're like, oh, man, I went through all that suffering for nothing. I was totally wrong in my assumption. How do we find out that we're wrong? We get more information, right? We get more information. We go to the source. We get more accurate information than what our minds are sort of fictionalizing, making up. We fill in the picture, get a more complete view. That's what our mindfulness, wise mindfulness practice does. It gives us a more complete picture so that we can dispel. Well, you know, it does a bunch of things at the same time. As we are directly observing our experience moment by moment, we are seeing what is the nature of reality in this moment. We're practicing stepping out of what we assume this moment of life to be. And we are looking directly and seeing this moment of reality reveal itself in our awareness, show us what it is. It would be like asking our friend, what were you thinking just then? So we're using our mindfulness to let this moment of pain or happiness or a moment of processing sound, understanding the nature of hearing or any of our senses, understanding how our minds are responding moment by moment to life and the different activities that we do. We are filling in all the blanks. We are stepping out of what we think we know, our assumptions, and looking and seeing what actually is. That's what our the Eightfold Path of Practice with the mind training, the mindfulness training at the center of it, is designed to do. Revelation of truth. And when that happens, when we see more and more clearly over time and over with having more continuity and more moments of mindfulness, less moments of being buying into the assumptions, we start to automatically put together the more complete picture. We see the reality, it becomes really obvious all of a sudden when our thinking is in contradiction to that. And when we are thinking wrongly about some aspect of life, there's this rub. And we're acting out of those wrong assumptions, there's this rub. We're rubbing. The reason why there's stress and suffering in that disconnect is because we are out of harmony with the nature of things, with the design of things. We are out of kilter. The Buddha, you know, last night Dave was talking about dukkha, this word dukkha, D-U-K-K-H-A, which is the word that the Buddha coined to describe all manner of stress and suffering. All manner of it. From dissatisfaction to the afflictive emotions to, you know, long-standing patterns of suffering and so on. Dukkha sort of describes it all. And he, like Shakespeare, he used existing terminology and he coined different ways of using that word. He took everyday words in the Pali language and then he had applied them in the Dharma in a unique and original way, just like Shakespeare did with the English language. And so with this word dukkha, before the Buddha used it in his first noble truth, describing the nature of suffering, it was used this, to describe like a, when a wagon wheel is misaligned off its axle, or when a limb is out of joint, disjointed, you know? And I when I discovered that original use of the word dukkha, it really hit me because there's so much in that. It's like, yeah, there's something awry. There's something out of joint or disconnected or out of alignment with dukkha. And that was my understanding of it, you know, as a practitioner. And the other thing that's in that word, though, is the hope that it's fixable. It's not a permanent condition, do you know? We can actually come back in alignment once we recognize that there's a problem. I mean, if your wagon wheel is crooked, you are in for a bumpy ride, right? That's what dukkha is. We are bumping along through life, thinking wrongly about things, and all we need to do is to correct that wrong view, replace ignorance with wisdom, and our wheels align and we have a smooth ride. And as we practice, it's been my experience that from the very first moment we start practicing, start watching ourselves, start gathering the information we need to get to create this or reveal this fuller, complete picture, the smoother things get. It just starts getting more and more easeful from the very beginning. It just, the ride smooths out. We're sort of fixing our wagon wheel as we go. It happens automatically. So we can think of plenty of examples, I'm sure, where our incorrect or incomplete thinking about the design of things or the way things are has caused us stress and suffering. Not that many of you here maybe dealing with the suffering of aging, but I am. A lot of you are too young yet. But for those of you who aren't too young, I'll offer this. What would be our relationship to our feelings about aging if we really knew the truth that it is a part of life? It is an inescapable part of life. It's part of the design of things that we cannot, that any, I mean, what might it be if we just knew in our hearts that aging was natural, completely natural, and a part of life that is inescapable and that all of us experience. As certainly as we will taste a certain thing when we taste salt or sweet, because our tongues are designed this way to interact with it, so we age. And we run into problems because we buy into some cultural assumptions that this shouldn't be happening. Well, there's something going wrong here. There's something awry with the aging thing. You know? Maybe it's in the design of things, but the design is faulty, okay? If we have to age, if we have to die, then, you know, and get sick and that the design is faulty. And, you know, when you become conscious of those background ways of thinking, do you see how, like, conceited it is? Like human beings going, well, that's not right. Well, that's not right that trees are made like that and that I have to age. What was the creator thinking or whatever, the designer thinking? That's dumb. It's dumb to think it's not right. It is really the truth. I find all the time that I'm suffering because I catch this background assumption that I shouldn't be getting wrinkles and I shouldn't be losing my muscle tone and I shouldn't be, you know, all this stuff that the culture has labeled as wrong or bad. What's up with that? I'm not going to buy into that dumb idea anymore. Well, actually, I will. I will buy into it because it's a long-standing conditioning, but I will keep waking up to it. I will keep waking up to that I'm believing in a wrong idea, especially knowing that it has caused me so much stress and suffering and pain in the past. I've been there with it, with my practice. How would we relate to our emotions, painful emotions, let's say specifically, if we really knew in our hearts that they belonged, that a human being is designed to feel emotion? That there's, you know, a lot of us have been afflicted with the conditioning that we're not supposed to feel, or at least we're not supposed to feel negative. I'm putting quotes around that word, negative things. The emotions that make other people, it makes them uncomfortable to see. Why? Because they feel empathy. They feel compassion. And a lot of people are not comfortable with feeling compassion when someone else, seeing someone else in pain. We are not comfortable with seeing ourselves in pain, you know. As Dave was talking about this afternoon, we think there's something going wrong when we feel painful emotion. But there isn't anything going wrong. We're sensitive creatures. We're designed to feel this way. We have this whole circuitry in the brain that's about emotion. And it's part of our makeup. And we can no more escape that than we can escape aging. You know? So it's the question is not whether this emotion is wrong or doesn't belong. It's more like how do we relate to it? How we relate to it is what makes an emotion afflictive, suffering or not. If we were able to view it as this too belongs, this belongs in this moment, the conditions that have gone together to make this moment of anger, they're already past. And what I'm seeing now is what they've created. So I cannot change those past conditions. All I can do is meet this emotion right here, right now. Can I meet it with this sense of, as Dave was saying today, I see you. You belong. Have you heard of Kristen Neff? Yeah. She does this wonderful program on self-compassion. And one of the practice suggestion she offers in that program is called mindful self-compassion break. Self-compassion break. That means that when you're feeling pain at any time during the day, you could take a little self-compassion break. And there's three steps to it, and they're pretty much what Dave did this afternoon. First, mindfulness. Recognize what's happening when it's happening. Ah, I'm feeling grief. That's what's happening right now. Two, this belongs. To actively step out of any background assumptions that we may be operating from where we think that this painful feeling shouldn't be here and that it's not human and that we're not alone in this feeling, that millions and millions of people around the world, everywhere, you know, feel grief, sadness, whatever, this feeling. We are not alone in this. It's human to feel grief. So that's an important second step, to sort of normalize it, normalize the experience. This helps to undercut the next thing that happens when we feel like something doesn't belong, we don't want it, we feel aversive, then we kind of travel along into all of the mental proliferation that goes into the aversiveness, how we try to get rid of, avoid, shut down, medicate, all the examples Dave gave today, that emotion. It's because we don't want to feel it, because we have a view that it shouldn't be here, it's wrong and bad, and so on. There's something going wrong. Part of that may come from our family conditioning, like I had, where you don't show painful emotions in my family. That wasn't allowed. You don't rock the boat with any sort of emotional expression. You just kind of smile and carry on. Very Lutheran, I guess. We weren't Lutheran, but And I mean, I don't know. It's that Protestant ethic, I guess. And so that's what I had internalized. And so, of course, I developed, you know, a sort of, I had all kinds of ways of avoiding my emotions. But what I inherited was based in this incorrect view, an incomplete picture, inaccurate view that somehow emotions are not allowed or they don't belong in this moment, which is really going against the design of things in a big way. And so I've suffered, and those of you who have also this conditioning may already be familiar with that form of suffering as well. So there is let me just say that with this operating under this ignorance, when we operate under our assumptions in this way and we believe in them fully, which, yeah, there's like a couple different ways I can go right now. So I'll go this way. I'm going to take the right turn here. In the first noble truth where the Buddha defines suffering and he talks about all the different ways we can suffer existentially, birth is suffering, illness, aging, death is suffering. Then he talks about the psychological ways we suffer, being separated from what is pleasing and having union with what is not pleasing, unpleasant. We suffer in those ways. And then he wraps up his definition of dukkha, suffering is the translation we use in English, by saying, in brief, the aggregates subject to clinging are suffering. What? One of those Dharma phrases that needs to be unpacked. But it was basically his shorthand version of all suffering. In Pali, the phrase is upadana khanda. Upadana is translated as clinging, clinging attachment, clinging identification, grasping. It's translated in different ways. It's that attaching to experience. And khanda is a conceptual framework that the Buddha used to describe all of our human experience, our bodily experience and our mental experience, just to make it brief. So he said, you know, there's no suffering in the khanda, in our mind-body. Where the suffering is in the upadana, the clinging, identification. And that's what I mean when I say we are believing in our assumptions. There is no problem if inaccurate or incomplete thoughts arise in our mind. It's when we believe in them, and we believe they're true, and we take them as the truth when they're not. That's what is the condition for all the different forms of suffering that we feel. So the Buddha was pointing in this First Noble Truth teaching directly to, you guys need to understand upadana. Check it out. See it for yourself. See when you are clinging to the contents of your mind or any other aspect of your experience. Dave and I are going to really explore this idea of clinging, because the suffering is the clinging. That's the definition of suffering, is clinging. And the freedom from suffering is letting go. Letting go of the clinging. Recognizing that the assumption that you're believing in is wrong. When that happens, when you have that insight that you're holding on to an incorrect assumption, the mind will let go. Wisdom will let go. Especially when we see that believing in that wrong assumption is causing us stress, pain, contraction, difficulty. It's causing us to act and behave in ways that are causing harm to ourselves and others. When those connections are made by that part of our mind that makes connections, not the thinking mind, not the rational thinking mind, but this much intuitive wisdom mind that collects all the information, sees the complete picture and goes, oh, I'm thinking wrongly. Actually, Stu liked that talk because he told me. I got all the information. The clinging to the feelings of less than, failure, you know, and whatever proliferates out of that, I shouldn't be a Dharma teacher. I failed. You know, and then even acting out of these crazy, wild assumptions, that all dissipates in a moment. There's the letting go because we've let go of clinging to the wrong idea, wrong assumption. That's it in a nutshell. That is our path of practice. But it just takes a while for us to unearth all of these wrong views and assumptions that we're holding on to. And this is why it's so very, very beneficial, precious, and helpful for us to have, you know, the great gift of the teachings of the Buddha and of other, you know, awakened beings. He awakened to these deep truths of the nature of the design of things. And with this awakened mind that saw clearly how suffering came to be, he can say to us, point out to us where we might be thinking wrongly. He can say, hey, you know, I see that you're thinking of this experience of anger or distress or whatever this way, but here's another perspective. You might not be seeing the whole picture. You might not be seeing the whole picture. And without that a wise mind offering us wise view as an alternative perspective, we might remain stuck in our wrong assumptions forever and in this cycle of samsara, of chasing after happiness in all the wrong places that Dave mentioned last night. I think that was the word he used, actually, chasing after happiness. We'll never be able to find it, you know? So that's why the teachings are so precious, because they can shift us into other possibilities. And one of the teachings that he offered, of course, was this Eightfold Path of Practice, which is the methodology, the practices and the training, the methods by which by which truth is revealed, and the fact that we're thinking wrongly about things, and then that suffering that comes from that disconnect. All of those three things, that's what frees us, seeing all of those things clearly. Okay. All right, so as an example of this kind of teaching that we are offered by the Buddha, I want to share a sutta that he offered as a different way of looking at this tendency of our minds, what we do, how we experience all sense phenomena as pleasant or unpleasant, right? I'm sure you've seen throughout the course of your 2 days of practice plenty of pleasant experiences and unpleasant experiences, right? And you've seen them all come and go. And you've seen some pleasant, and then there's some unpleasant, and then there's some pleasant again, and some unpleasant. You've just been watching that. And this is why we practice, and why we practice in retreat. Because when we see that directly, it's really clear that experience comes in these two packages. Three, actually. Then there's neutral. Neither pleasant nor unpleasant. But we have a particular conditioned way in our mind, of responding to pleasant experience and unpleasant experience. And Dave was pointing to that last night. So here's a teaching, the Buddha, it's called the Dart teaching, in which he reflected on what happens when we buy into these habits of mind that have assumptions behind them, wrong assumptions about the nature of life. So he said, the Buddha said this, practitioners, when the uninstructed worldling is being touched by a painful feeling, the uninstructed worldling is people who don't practice, basically, people who don't have a spiritual practice. When the uninstructed worldling is being touched by a painful feeling, he worries, grieves, and laments. He weeps, beating his breast, and becomes distraught. He feels two feelings, a bodily one and a mental one. So he feels the first painful sensation in the body. This could also apply to a painful emotion. He feels pain in the body. And then he feels this next painful feeling, which is how the mind is processing that, relating to it. Weeping, beating his breast, becoming distraught. In other words, complains. Complaining about the pain or feeling aversive towards it or not liking it, really not liking it. It is as if a man were pierced by a dart and following that would be the painful feeling. And following the first piercing, he is hit by a second dart. The second dart being the, woe is me, I'm in pain. I hate this pain. I hate this pain. Rather than compassion, I care about this pain. So too, when the uninstructed worldling is being touched by a painful feeling, he feels two feelings, a bodily one and a mental one. All right, so now this is where the Buddha is showing us, you know, how to view, how to start to look at how our minds are responding to pain. To bring our practice to it and say, is this true for me? Is this how my mind responds to pain? Well, we all know that's true. We hate it. We hate pain, right, mostly. We try to avoid it and all of that stuff. So having been touched by that painful feeling, he, in other words, resists it and resents it. Then in him who resists and resents that painful feeling, an underlying tendency of resistance against that painful feeling comes to underlie his mind. That means that as we resist it and then we get caught up in the resistance, we cling to the resistance and buy into it. I hate this. This shouldn't be here. I have got to get rid of this. I've got to avoid this. Okay, I better go watch TV or whatever. We buy into it and act out of it. We are reinforcing the pattern of resistance. That's what he means by it comes to underlie the mind. We are reinforcing the existing pattern of responding to pain with resistance. Being, therefore, because we are adding insult to injury here with the second dart, not just one dart, we're doubling our pleasure. No, not pleasure, we're doubling our pain. We're doubling our pain, and it becomes so big and so overwhelming that what do? Because the uninstructed, being touched by painful feeling, he seeks delight in sensual pleasure. That's what we do. It's too much to feel both the painful feeling and the hatred of the painful feeling, which contracts the mind and just makes it really unbearable. So the only thing that we can think to do is, I'm going to go get a candy bar. I'm going to go get high. I'm going to go watch TV. I'm going to disassociate. I'm going to, whatever it is, our sense pleasure. I'm going to have sex. I'm going to, whatever. Okay. And this is my favorite part of the sutta. The Buddha says, for what reason does he seek delight in sensual pleasure? Because the uninstructed worldling does not know any escape from painful feeling other than sensual pleasure. Because the uninstructed worldling does not know another way. That's speaking directly to this wrong assumption. There is an assumption that we have received from our culture and other sources of conditioning that has told us that pain is bad, should be resisted and avoided at all costs, and if you're feeling pain, go find pleasure to wipe it out, to get rid of it. You must get rid of it, and you do that with pleasure. And we find happiness, and we also, there's this underlying assumption that we've all bought into, that we're conflating happiness with sense pleasure. We're conflating happiness with pleasure. And that's a bummer. Because that means that we'll never really be happy, because sense pleasure, as you've been observing these last 2 days, comes and goes. And that's the next thing that the Buddha says. He does not know, according to the facts, the arising and ending of these feelings, pain and pleasure. He also does not know, about the gratification, the danger, and the escape connected with these feelings. So that is pointing to we're unaware of the danger in the gratification. Of course it's gratifying to go seek sense pleasure in response to pain. Of course, momentarily, or for as long as the pleasure lasts. We forget about the pain. But then it doesn't last, so there's a danger, because what we're doing is we're reinforcing the pattern of pleasure seeking. And that's, again, reinforcing that chasing after happiness in the wrong places where we can never find it. Only temporarily. It can't take refuge there, as Dave has said several times. So there's danger in that we're reinforcing the pattern. And we are also unaware, the uninstructed worldling, that there is an escape. There's actually an escape from the chase. And it's right in this place of recognizing the impermanence of pleasure and pain. Really seeing it clearly. This is one of those basic design of things that the Buddha suggested we see. Impermanence. In particular, the impermanence of pleasure and discomfort, pleasure and pain. They come, they go, different conditions come together and it's pleasant, experienced as pleasant. Then other ones come together and experience as pain, constantly changing. When we are continuously aware over periods of time, like we are in this retreat, we get that. We get it experientially. And over time, in our, you know, it's really, really hard to uproot this assumption that we can find happiness in sense pleasure. It's just deeply ingrained, isn't it? And so we need to keep meeting that with our knowledge and understanding of impermanence. And also our understanding of how we've experienced the suffering of the chase. How we keep getting disappointed over and over again, as Dave mentioned last night. Very, very, very profound teaching. And so, you know, then he, the second part of the sutta, he talks about what the well-taught noble disciple, how the well-taught noble disciple meets a painful feeling. And it's a little bit different. When the well-taught noble disciple, that is someone with who's on the practice path, who has some measure of wise view, understanding of the design of things, in particular impermanence in this case. When, I'm going to change the pronoun, when she is touched by a painful feeling, this well-taught noble disciple, she does not worry, grieve, or lament. She does not weep, beating her breast and become distraught. It is one kind of feeling she experiences, the bodily one, without the mental feeling. That mental feeling, that second dart, is the optional suffering that the Buddha says we can let go of. He promises that we can let go of, that we can, by recognizing that it's there, by seeing it clearly, and where it comes from. So it's as if a woman were pierced by a dart, but was not hit by the second dart following the first one. And that person experiences feelings caused by a single dart only. So too, when the instructed noble disciple is touched by a painful feeling, she feels just the one. So it's a little bit less. You know, there's still the pain, as Dave said. There's still the pain. But there's no resistance or resentment. And all the proliferation and avoidance strategies and whatnot and unskillful behavior that comes from that resistance. And the resistance itself can be really clearly experienced as dukkha and contraction. You know, this is what okay, I'll come back to that. Hence, in her, so we're also not reinforcing that these tendencies. We are developing a new habit of how to relate to pain. So, you know, how do we go from being an uninstructed worldling to well-taught noble disciple? We follow the Eightfold Path of Practice. I'll give an example of, you know, the kinds of practices that we can do that can help to reveal these truths and reveal the design of things and reveal these, especially the details of how we suffer, how our suffering comes to be. You know, for example, with this pain thing, we can do some really simple kinds of exercises. One of the things that mindfulness practices that I offer to introductory, even beginning level people, is to the ice cube meditation. You guys know the ice cube meditation? No? Okay, it's where I ask people to put an ice cube in a cup, and I ask people to hold on to the ice cube with their hand while paying attention to it mindfully, while observing themselves, while observing, you know, getting the mindful awareness in there and feeling the sensations of the cold. We are letting go, stepping out of our assumptions of what we think cold is, what our mind believes is cold, and we're going for the direct evidence. This is the experience of cold moment by moment. And you can get close in there and see the changing sensations of cold that may be experienced as burning. Or, you know, there's maybe discomfort. Some people like it, right? There's different ways. And then we see the actual detail in the sensations. And then we see the mind reacting. We can watch that too. We can watch the mind be aversive to the cold. Like right away, ooh, I don't like this. We can watch the mind have associations. And we can watch all that instead of believing in it, the upadana, instead of clinging to it. And by watching that whole dynamic mind-body process of cold, we learn what it is. We learn its nature. Then its nature reveals itself. And so the next time we feel cold, our relationship to cold may have changed. And so we can take little exercises, mindfulness exercises like that, which is where we're heading now in the next few days with our practice. We're going to head into this, what's called Vipassana territory. We use our collected continuity of mindfulness to start to observe our experience as mind-body process. With the wise attitude, you know, that we're looking at it that way, with curiosity. What is this? I'm going to step out of what I think I know about this discomfort I'm feeling right now, this pain in my knee, and see what it actually is. I'm going to step out of what I think I know about eating and see what it is when I experience it right now. Or sadness, any emotional state, and so on. We're going to start to investigate our experience in this way so that it can reveal itself. And the revelation of all these details, this information, just will completely put the lie to any wrong assumptions that we have over time and free us from the suffering of believing in those assumptions. That's how we find freedom through the Eightfold Path, the wisdom-based Eightfold Path. And when we do this, we also are, it's called, I haven't looked at my last page here. We start to come more, as we release the wrong assumptions and come into behaving and responding out of the facts or recognition of the design of things, then we come into harmony, more harmony and ease. This is why our suffering reduces. And the other phrase that's used to describe this release, we will spontaneously let go of the clinging to the wrong ideas when we see they're wrong, when we see they're causing suffering, and we feel it. We see it directly. There's a letting go that happens, and we feel the relief of that letting go. And you might be feeling a little bit of it every time you come back from being lost in a train of thought. It's why I'm asking you to pay attention to yourself when you wake up from being lost in a train of thought. How do you feel? You can feel the residue of the upadana khanda, of having been buying into this movie of the mind that was just occurring. I have never once come back from being lost in a train of thought when I didn't feel contraction. I might even feel some pretty strong, intense emotions, afflictive emotions in that moment of waking up, depending on what I was thinking about, right? And buying into what I was thinking about. Being caught up in it, identifying with it, clinging to it. That's the problem right there. And so That's how I've trained, one of the ways that I've trained myself in recognizing dukkha and the causality of dukkha and how it's connected. It is this clinging. So I feel that contraction. I know dukkha is present. I know there's some wrong assumption going on there. I just need to keep paying attention until I see it. And this process is called the sure heart's release. Also, and the reason it's called that is because as we step out of being entangled in, or I like the word enchanted. Dave used hypnotized. I like that too. Being hypnotized by the mind chasing after pleasure, say. I like enchantment because it's like a spell we're under that can be broken. So when we step out of the enchantment, when we break the spell and we stop being obsessively involved and entangled in our plans and thoughts about how to make our lives better or whatever, how to fix this problem that's sort of an imaginary problem often. But, things not being right now, so we need to chase after happiness in the future, so we're... Blah, blah. When we step out of that obsession, those movies, that entanglement, and we just come back to the simplicity of the here and now, our heart, what we call our heart, comes rushing in. These heart qualities of loving kindness, compassion, equanimity, balance, and joy, appreciation. Those will come rushing in when we stop being obsessed with chasing for happiness in the wrong way, in the wrong places. We come into harmony with life, and the heart is right there in that wisdom that knows truth, that knows the design of things and is in harmony with it. The beautiful emotions are there too, these limitless, measureless emotions of heart. The heart's sure release. So our heart is released, and we are free to act from that place, rather than from the dukkha of wrong view, incorrect view. This is why we practice. This is why we come to these crazy retreats, to see clearly how we are thinking wrongly about things, and how we don't need to, we can let go of clinging to those wrong thoughts, wrong assumptions. Let the truth of things reveal itself, and to take refuge in that truth. That they're always, to me, comforting truths. Emotions belong. Where we are right now is okay. We don't need to be anywhere else. Things are constantly changing. All of these truths that become self-evident. The Buddha said, this holy life, meaning the life of this spiritual practice we're undertaking here, this holy life does not have gain, honor, and renown for its benefit, or the attainment of virtue for its benefit, or the attainment of concentration for its benefit, or knowledge and vision for its benefit. But it is this unshakable deliverance of mind that is the goal of this holy life, its heartwood, and its end. Unshakable deliverance of mind. We're being delivered into the truth of things, the Dhamma. So I offer that for your reflection. Thank you so much for your attention. Let's just sit for a moment or two and...
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.